Today what I wanted to do is kind of take a little departure. What we've been doing is going through the Sermon on the Mount, and we had just finished the Beatitudes and Salt and Light, which, as I mentioned before, is Jesus' introduction, right, through the whole nut of his teaching, which is contained in the Sermon on the Mount. In the Beatitudes, he told us, he gave us a description of what a kingdom person looks like. And then in Salt and Light, he gave us the effect that such a person has on everyone around him. And where we're going to go to next is his actual mission statement. What is he doing? Which takes us into a discussion of what the law is all about. And we have all sorts of different notions of what the law means. And then into his topic sentence in Matthew 5:20, where he basically lays out the whole theme of his ministry and mission. So we'll be getting into that starting next week. But I had something else on my mind all this week as we've been preparing for the Children of the Americas fundraiser, which we did last night. And it was a crazy, crazy week, just trying to get everything together. I had never done anything like that before, so I was baptized with fire this last month. Insane amount of preparation, even for the small thing that we did. But it was a wonderful evening. There was 100 people there, so we had 13 women and children come up from Mexico who are working in the neighborhoods in which we feed our children and help them get the school supplies and everything that they need to stay in school and be successful. But it was interesting. After the evening was over, my van wouldn't start, so Marion and I are sitting in the van trying to get the van started, and Grendel and Monica are kind of backwards sitting there, so they're talking to us through the window. And we're just making conversation because we're waiting to see if this thing is actually going to start. And Monica asked me what my favorite part of the evening was. And it didn't take me long to think of the moment. It was when we brought up, I was doing a presentation about the organization, and I brought up all those women and those children from Mexico to stand with me and be there to let the people see them, but also to have a few of the women talk to the group and tell them in their own words through a translator what the work meant to them, what it was that they do, and their connection with these children. And especially when Rosenda spoke, who has been managing kind of our flagship dining room for the last 18 years or so. And she broke down with emotion because the connections that have happened in the years that we've been working in Mexico have created these deep, deep relationships. I truly believe that the greatest and most lasting change and good in the world is not created from the top down. It's not a few people at the top reaching millions through some sort of global network. It's when lots of people at the bottom reach up and connect. You know, I'd much rather have a million people reaching one or two folks than one or two folks reaching millions. Because when it comes that way, everything connects. Relationships are formed. You know, we know we've been working in these neighborhoods for 30 years, and we know these women, we know that the children, and they know the children, and we try to stay out of their way as much as we can. But what was coming to me so strongly, and what I think came across to the people, is that this is truly an extended family that reaches across that border, that artificial line that's drawn between our countries. The Mexicans call it el otro lado, which means the other side. And it's so interesting when you hear, especially the children, ask you questions about what life is like on the other side. You know, and do they have trash on the hills on the other side? Do they do this on the other side? You know, they're curious. They want to know. Because they've heard of this great country to the north, but they don't really know it. It's very difficult for them, obviously, to get there. And the amount of familiar and familial connection, I think, was what came across so strongly to me. And that's what I've been thinking about all week. It's what I tried to get across last night. And I think it's what I want to try to get across to you this morning. 34 years ago, 1974, our founder of Children of the Americas went to Mexico and for the first time set foot in the orphanage at Santa Teresita. And just his impression of the children, of the conditions in which they were living, just seared his consciousness, seared his soul. And he was never the same. For the next 30 years of his life, it was dedicated to the children. And he created one organization, and then he created Children of the Americas in 1984. But it was that one contact, that one connection with those children that changed everything for him. He made a connection with them. He looked into their eyes and he saw something that changed who he was. And then, in the early 80s, I met Paul, and that was his name, Paul Weiss, in Santa Barbara. And there was something in him that connected me to him. And because of his passion for these children and this work, I went to Mexico. And I looked into those same eyes. And I saw what he saw. And for the last 25 years, I've been connected, not only to those children, but all of the people, the volunteers and the workers in Children of the Americas. And then about 7 or 8 years ago, a friend of mine, Norm, who I knew at the church I was at, just to humor me, I think, or to at least support me, said, okay, yes, I will go to Mexico with you. One trip was all it took for Norm. And he was forever touched by the children that he saw. And for the last 7 years, Norm has done nothing except work for these kids and continue to go down there. And Norm is the man on the ground in Mexico. I kind of come and go, and a lot of my work is here, but Norm is the one in the neighborhoods. Norm is the one that these women last night spoke so familiarly about. If you notice that, any of you who were there, it was all Norm, 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 right? He is the one that they know. He is known throughout these hillsides in Mexico. He has created those kind of relationships. And so, from Paul to me to Norm, from Norm to Sharon and Tim Beck and all these others at Norm, there is this infection that is taking place and a connection. It's infection and connection. You know, the kids infect Paul and Paul infects me and then I infect Norm and Norm infects Sharon. And this wavefront goes out of people connecting with each other and seeing each other really as they are and seeing what those needs are and being moved not only in emotion or in sympathy, but actually move to action, to do something. And this is what is so beautiful about Kingdom. This is the way it works. It's always from the inside out. It's not from the outside in. It's always from the bottom up, not from the top down. And it's always from the backside to the front side. It's never from front to back. You know, I got to stand up as president last night and kind of be the star. And it's not that way. It's the people who are never seen that do the work, that are the most connected. Not that I can't be connected as president too, but sometimes there's a conflict of interest in there, and we have to recognize that. Whenever we take people down to Mexico for the first time, I'm always fascinated to gauge and try to see what their first reaction to true poverty is like. How they're going to react when they see these children, when they see the conditions for the first time. It's fascinating to me because people react all over the map. Some of them are completely devastated by the conditions, by the poverty, and it's really, really difficult for them emotionally. Other people are just simply transported by the eyes of the children. The fact that these children don't know they're poor, the fact that these children don't care that they're poor, the fact that these children don't even know what they're missing. They're just children. They're children like any other. And the smallest thing just sends them into the stratosphere. You should see them when they get a backpack full of school supplies. You would think that you gave them the Eiffel Tower or something. I don't know. It is amazing. It's Christmas in September every time. And you give them some little toy or a piece of candy. They just see you coming in the streets and they're running to you. And the openness and how you react to that says so much about where you are in your own journey. When you are confronted with something like a child, with someone who can't possibly ever pay you back, someone who can't possibly ever give you something in return. When you meet those marginalized people and you are moved to some sort of action or not, if you're terrified, if you fly back into yourself, you know, it's everything about who we are as people and where we are in this journey that Jesus has set for us. And this is why I find it so interesting as I do this work. And I have to gauge myself too, because we all kind of oscillate on this journey as we go. And I find myself at times much more present than other times. And when I walk away from an encounter that I don't carry a good memory from, I have to think about that. Where was I? What was I thinking? What was I doing? What went on there? You know? And so what I would like to talk a little bit about this morning is, how do we become people who are infected and connected by those that we see around us? And what are the roadblocks to that anyway? What is it that keeps us from being those kind of people? I think, you know, one of them is that sometimes we have this sort of, this limited sense of what connection is all about. You know, I'm connected to Americans because I'm an American. You know, I'm connected to Raiders fans because I'm a Raider fan. There was a one of the migrant worker fields that we were working in down in Central Baja was called Rancho Marcial, and there was a landowner there who ran a work camp. And the migrant workers, mostly Oaxacan Indians, would come in and they would live in these corrugated shacks. I mean, you couldn't believe it. You wouldn't put your storage stuff in these shacks. And yet whole families were living in them. They were no bigger than a standard bedroom in one of our tract homes. And you'd have families with 7, 8 children living in these enclosures. Corrugated metal over just a rough frame. Think about what that's like in the sun. I mean, what that does. It was like ovens in there. And these people would come in and they would live and they would work the fields and then they would move on. But there was one family that had been there for 7 years and they had 8 children and they're living in one of these rude shacks. And they had been kind of overseeing a lot of the farm work that was going on. And the landowner had his house. You could throw a rock literally as maybe 50, 60 yards. And you go over and you look at his house, and his house wouldn't have been out of place here in Dana Point. It was actually had a lawn. It was irrigated. There were big palm trees. It was this beautiful, beautiful home. Had all of the utilities and comforts that we're used to here in this country. And I remember thinking, how in the world do you lay your head down on your pillow at night, knowing that just that far away, the family that's been working with you for 7 years is living on that urine-soaked mattress with 7 kids and 2 parents sleeping all together there? How do you do that? How do you not make the connection that's only 50 yards away? That these people, if you just put maybe $1,000 into what their living conditions, you could improve it just off the charts as far as their standard and what they're concerned with. How do you not make that connection? It just boggles the mind. But I'm sure that landowner, who seemed like a very nice fellow, I met him, we shook hands, we talked, and he smiled, who loved his children and kissed them and tucked them in at night, but couldn't consider the children of this mother and father whom he had employed for so long as being of the same stuff. You know, how do you... You remember stories in World War II of Nazi soldiers who were running the concentration camps, could spend all day long killing and torturing whole families and children, and then could go home and tuck their children in at night and kiss them on the forehead, not seeing that these children are all children. They're all the same. But these are mine, and those are theirs. And I remember a Christian pastor actually telling his congregation that the Bible tells us, mandates, that we are to love and relate to Christians differently than we are to relate to non-Christians. Where does that come from? I mean, this is not the Gospels that I read. And yet, they see it there. They interpret it that way. And they live that way. That there's this us and them sort of disconnect, that these are ours and this doesn't happen. So there's this limited sort of, almost like a bubble over our awareness. Anything within the bubble, we recognize, we can connect to. But outside that bubble, it just doesn't exist. And I guess everybody has a different size bubble. I mean, some of us can only relate to ourselves. Someone can relate to us and one other person, you know, a significant other. Others can include the nuclear family. Others can include the extended family. Others can include their own church or their sports team or their whatever it is that they identify with. Others can include a nation. And then some other, you know, old souls, I suppose, can include the whole human race inside their bubble. But we have to recognize, where is the limits of our bubble? Who is it that we're shelving out? Who is it that we see as not of us, that we can disregard, that we can let go of, that we can just not relate to? Are there those in our path that we can set aside that way? And I think that there's even something deeper. I think there's a fear also at the root. There's probably fear at the root of everything. But this fear tells us that life is really a zero-sum game. You know, there's only so many resources to go around, and I better get mine first, because if they get theirs, then there may not be enough for me. And there's that kind of attitude where, gosh, you know, if I give here, if I do this, if I do that, then you know, maybe there won't be enough. Jesus told, I think, probably my favorite story in the Gospels at Luke 15, when he talked about the parable of the prodigal son. And I know you're probably all familiar with it, but just to go over it again. A wealthy landowner has two sons. And the younger one comes to him one day and says, "Father, give me my share of the inheritance now. And let me go, because I want to go live the way I want to live." And inexplicably, amazingly, the father actually does it. He gives him his share of the inheritance, and the boy takes it and he goes away. And he goes to a faraway land, and he lives, you know, high on the hog and in all sorts of degenerate sort of living, goes through his entire inheritance, and ends up down and out, finds himself actually living in a pigsty and eating the slop that the pigs are fed. Finally, comes to his senses and said, "Wait a minute, the hired hands at my father's house live better than this. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go home and I'm going to tell my father that I'm not worthy to be your son anymore because of what I've done, but just take me on as one of your hired hands and that will be enough." And he has this speech. You can just imagine him walking back toward his father's estate, rehearsing this over and over in his mind, what he's going to say. You know, probably sweating bullets, because he knows what he's probably in for when he sees his father. His father doesn't even let him get the words out of his mouth. Cuts him off, throws his arms around him, showers him with kisses, and then immediately tells the hired hands to kill a fatted calf and to prepare a feast, because his son has come home. Now, before we go any further in the story, we got to get into the context of the ancients, because there's things here that we just don't get. Just like the parable of the Good Samaritan, you know, it's like, okay, it sounds really good, but unless you understand how absolutely hated on a national level the Samaritans were by the Jews, you don't get the import of what Jesus is saying. And likewise here, in a communal society, the families stayed together and they just kept extending. Women who married sons of the father came and lived with the son in the father's house. And thereby the estates grew. And all of the wealth was passed down from generation to generation, was designed to stay within the family. It was the family's survival. You have to understand, for this son to ask his father to give his inheritance now, to take it away from the family, was just like saying, "Father, I wish you were dead. Father, you're as good as dead to me. Father, this family means absolutely nothing to me. Father, I am willing to take what could be the life-saving sustenance out of this family for my own purposes." In a communal society, this is absolutely devastating. The hearers that were listening to Jesus tell the story would have gasped. Such a thing was unthinkable. That you would do this to the family, that you would show that disrespect for your father, first of all, and then to ask such a thing. It would be punishable by death. It would be the worst thing that you could possibly do. And yet, what does a father do? Without a sound, without a whimper, without so much as an objection, he gives him the inheritance and lets him go. And so when he comes back, what do you think the reaction would normally be under such circumstances? And yet what we see happening is that this father probably never spent a moment from the time his son left, but was praying for his return and watching for his return. Because the story tells us when he was still a long way off. In other words, picture this old man looking out his window, catching the first sight of his son coming over the rise. And imagine the rush that came over him, the intake of breath. And what does he do? He bolts out that door and starts running. And you got to picture this. An ancient Hebrew patriarch with his robes pulled up so that he can run, you know, skinny white legs and knobby knees flashing as he goes as fast as he can. You got to see the beard flying out behind him like a banner. Hebrew patriarchs didn't run. It was undignified. Hebrew patriarchs did not show their skin in public. It was indecent. They don't do these things. And Hebrew patriarchs did not allow their family to be compromised in any way. They would fight wars before they would allow such a thing to happen. And here is this old man running to his son, who came straight from the pigsties, covered with excrement and sweat. And he throws his arms around him. And the language in English is so weak, he kissed him. But the language in the Greek and the Aramaic means he couldn't stop kissing him. He was showering him with kisses. He was putting his face into that excrement-covered young man and was crying tears and kissing him over and over again and couldn't have cared less about any of the circumstances, only that his son was home. Is that fair? Is that just? What in the world is going on here? And that's exactly what the older brother wants to know, isn't it? We can understand his reaction. What in the world are you doing? Here, I have stayed here all these years. I have stayed here by your side. I have worked faithfully in your fields, and you have never once so much as thrown me a party. And now this one comes home. This one who did this to our family, who should be killed where he stands. And you're going to kill the best calf that we have? You're going to throw this party? I'm not going to stand for this. We can understand. That is fair. The elder brother's sentiments and objections to his father are perfectly fair and just. But the father is not. Because perfect love is not just. And what is the elder brother worried about? I think that he's worried that if his younger brother gets a party, he may not get a party. There's only so many parties to go around, right? If he gets one, maybe I won't get one. But what he doesn't understand is that there is always another party in God's pocket. He will never run out of parties. And to diminish his brother in no way increases himself. It can't work that way. In fact, to diminish his brother is to diminish not only himself, but everybody, because it diminishes perfect love. The fear that we have that we won't get what it is that we think we need or what we want can only be cast out by perfect love, because perfect love always has another party in its pocket. You know, to God, every single one of us, Every one of us who has ever lived, who ever will live, is God's favorite. That's possible with him. It's not possible with us. We have a favorite. Everyone is God's favorite. Everyone is treated the same. What does the father say to his son, the elder brother? He says, you are always with me, and all I have is yours. What part of all don't we understand? If we have everything there is to have, how can we ever be diminished in any way? How can whatever anybody else gets ever diminish us if we already have everything there is to get? Jesus tells another wonderful story in Matthew 20, maybe my second favorite, where laborers go into the field early in the morning, midday, and late. Remember that one? And at the end of the day, they all get paid the same. And the ones who came early in the day are outraged because it's not fair. I worked 8 hours, they only worked 2, and you pay us the same. And of course the landowner says, well, we had a contract, we had a deal. I didn't renege. But there's something deeper than that. What we're not getting here is that the two are related. The wages that everybody gets is that all I have is yours. It's everything there is to have, everything there is to get are included in those wages. And as long as we come to the field, we will receive the same wage. It's everything. And to try to diminish someone else's is not to increase yours because you already have everything there is to get. If we can understand that, if we can understand the unjust nature of perfect love, if we can understand that that injustice in perfect love is all geared in our favor because we are God's favorite, we can start to let go of some of the fear that separates and divides us. We can start to practice that kind of all I have is yours attitude, mentality, and connection with everyone that we meet. Whether that person is in our family, whether that person is in Mexico, whether that person is on the moon, it doesn't matter. We're going to be able to be infected and connected to everyone if we understand how infected and connected God is to us. He is like that Father who is running to meet us, full tilt, no conditions, does not care one whit about the things that we think may infect or disconnect our relationship with Him. Let's get that. Let's try to see that. Keep that image of that old Father running down the hillside toward you in your mind. Whenever you feel disconnected, whenever you start to feel fearful, whenever you walk away from a contact with somebody and you realize you never looked them in the eye, and remember how connected we all are. It's made such a difference in my life to learn to just drop a little bit of the fear, to see these children's faces, to see my own children's faces. It makes a difference for all of us. Let's pray. And I did get a couple of questions, but next week. I will keep these for next week. Father, Your love is so radical. Your love is so incomprehensible. Your love breaks all the rules. Your love outrages and insults our sense of fair play, our sense of justice. Help us to move beyond the boundaries that we impose on ourselves as individuals, as whole societies, Lord. Help us to see the beauty in a love so vast as to be so unfair, but unfair in our favor. Help us to move into this radical nature of Your love, to get glimpses of it from time to time, that tell us that everything is okay, that this universe is a friendly place, that You are there and You infuse it all and You infuse us. And as we get those glimpses and we can drop our fear for a moment, help us to connect with each other in new and deeper ways. Help us to be able to give the person that we are in front of that which they need so desperately, which may just be a smile or a direct look into their eyes. Help us, Lord. We love you, but we are weak. We love you, but we want to love you more, and we want to know you more. Help us by showing us the love that you have for us. And we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen? All right. Hey, let's stand and let's see how big the circle is today.